Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. We're going to talk about some advanced threats today and some network operations on the internet. Our guest today, Jason Gould, is a consulting engineer for advanced threats at Arbor Networks. And Arbor Networks, what, about 17 years, I think, Jason, you said you started as a DARPA project. But welcome today, Jason. How are you?
I'm good, and thank you for the introduction. Yes, Arbor Networks was founded in the early part of this century as a DARPA project. We've grown from just focusing on initially DDoS to expanding into the advanced threat marketplace. We've sort of changed the game. You know, we're looking at new forms of traffic. We're correlating it in a different way. What I'd like to say today is to give you guys an opportunity to learn a little bit more about what we do as an organization and to address some topics that you guys have as clients and say, hey, what are the threat vectors that I need to focus on?
Yeah, definitely. So, Jason, though, before we dive into the technical or the company, tell us about yourself. You know, how did you get to where you're at? What excites you? What motivates you? Maybe even what was little Jason like? Things, you know, something interesting.
Something interesting. So little Jason was one of those guys who wanted to be a CIA agent when he grew up. I read books, and even into college, I always thought of myself as somebody who wanted to be, you know, meet with foreign leaders and have a spy and a cover and things like that. I didn't grow up to do that, but I did grow up to love technology. And these days, you know, being able to stop the attacks, the mass form of cyber attacks that are out there, I think is the number one threat that faces this country. I mean, everyone talks about World War III, and I'm like, World War III is not going to be bombs. World War III is going to be cyber threats. It's going to be stolen personal information. It's going to be stolen identities. It's going to be people who've had their identities hijacked, and maybe it's being held for ransom. Everybody talks about ransomware, and it's usually IP. It's usually digital assets. But what if ransomware were your identity? So that's something that I like to think of myself as. I want to be able to stop those type of attacks in my career. And I think that where I'm at now does a really good job of it.
You know what? I have heard so many, we have such a military population around here. I've heard people in the military actually kind of say, we're already in the middle of that World War III that you're talking about. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. So it's one of those things that is sort of like the governments of certain powers out there, Russia, North Korea, Ukraine, China, have been in this business for a long time. We've had U.S. CyberCom for 12, maybe 15 years. The individual departments, so Navy, Air Force, they all used to have individual ones, and obviously the NSA is very military connected. But the concept of having a joint unified command that was focused specifically on the cyber realm is something that's relatively new to the United States, and it is an area where we're clearly deficient. We need to spend a lot more time focusing on digital assets, focusing on the web, focusing on cutting down crime by policing the dark web. We don't do any of that today as a rule. We do it covertly but not overtly, and it's not something that individuals think about on a daily basis. We all need to get into that game, because if we want to make the web safe for our kids and for our future, and we want to become a more connected world, we're going to have to make the web a better place.
Interesting. What do you think about that? Maybe the web and a lot of the initial outlay of our technology was not designed to think about security. Maybe there's a web 2.0 that needs to come about, and maybe instead of focusing on policing such a large thing as ever-growing data sets, we start to look at a redesign of something that works better.
The redesign is already in place. So everyone talks about big data and data analytics and data lakes and things like that. What I think that we're looking for in our second version of the web is we're looking for a place where we can share information, but we can share information safely. Mm-hmm. And so we're already moving there from a technology perspective. We've moved from HTTP to HTTPS, we're moving to TLS, things like that. We're getting there in terms of technology. What we need to focus on in the next version is to iterate on those technologies as well as allow people to live safely, to live safe lives on the net. So that if you post a picture on Instagram, someone's going to know that you're not in Cancun. Someone's not going to be able to say, oh, they're in Cancun, let's go rob their house. Yeah. That if you're in Cancun and you're thinking to myself, oh, I forgot to lock the door to my house, you'll have Alexa or Cortana or Google Assistant be able to lock the doors to your house. You're like, hey, I forgot to lock the garage door. So that no one's going to come in and steal your stuff while you're doing that. That's going to be a combination of the Internet of Things. We've already got the various web technologies that allow us to stay connected via the route switch and the LANs and WANs of the world. But it's going to be a measure of enabling people to make themselves safer by being smarter.
Okay. Well, let's take a break here from our sponsors. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we want to talk about your primary industry problem, as you would define it. Be back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So welcome back. We're speaking with Jason Gould today, still from Arbor Networks. And Jason, we talked about before the break that we wanted to have your definition, your primary industry concern. Tell us what you think that is, either from the definition of Jason Gould or Arbor Networks, wherever you want to go with this one. What is the primary concern you see in the industry right now?
The primary concern that I see in the industry today is the unknown known. So what I mean by unknown known is we all have existing security tools out there. Everyone in the industry, every major business has a SIEM. They have an IPS/firewall or next generation firewall. They have endpoint protection and they have sandboxing. But the question becomes is what happens when something gets through any of those devices that hasn't been seen? That is all basically reliant on signatures, on someone having identified it as a known bad. What I see is the biggest problem is identifying those bads that don't have a signature, that are unknown to our modern security tools.
Okay. And if we had to say, how does that impact the average person? What would be your kind of, you know, I'm just somebody that works at a doctor's office. I go back and forth to work every day. Define that and explain that to me.
Define that and explain that to you. So if you work at an average doctor's office and you go on Amazon to buy a pair of tennis shoes or to buy a set of pots and pans, you want to be able to use your credit card safely from your person to Amazon, to the bank, and then back. And then you want to get your merchandise in the same way that if you had walked into Target or Walmart or something like that and purchased a set of pots and pans or a pair of tennis shoes with cash. Mm-hmm. All of that has put you as your own person, your personal identity on the web, as well as it's put your personal information in banking on the web. Because now if someone were to intercept that particular type of transaction, they would have access to your credit card information. They probably know your birth date. They definitely know your address. So what we try to do is to say, hey, all of these things out there, all of these different types of attacks that can get in between you and the merchant and the bank, that making sure that that type of attack is known. That's what we're trying to do. So if there's different vectors that they're going for, you know, maybe they're spoofing the browser, maybe you have keys that have been compromised. All of these things are ways that someone could get access to that type of information, and we want to cut down on the dwell time that comes from having access to that. So invariably, because hackers are really, really good at what they do, organizations are going to get breached. the goal is to cut down on how much time that the breach maintains itself within the organization. We call that term dwell time or mean time to contain. So that's a really big number these days. That's 200 days. What we're trying to do is cut that down from 200 days to 30 days. Because unlike, you know, a bank robbery where you go in, you want to steal whatever is in the cashier's drawers and then get out, that's not how hackers operate. They go in and they want access to Fort Knox. So if each individual bank had a Fort Knox, they want access to that, and then they want to go low and slow so they're not detected to get back out. Mm-hmm. So it's a command and control attack. It's lateral movement, execution, collection, exfiltration. Those are five of the big things that they're trying to do with the data that they're looking for, being your personal credit card, your information, as well as your address. What we try to say as an organization, as Arbor Networks, the security division of NetScout, we like to say, hey, we're going to help you do post-exploit visibility. So what that means is that if I'm working with an organization to say, hey, I need to cut down on that dwell time, I want to enable you to find the exploit as fast as possible and then shut it down as fast as possible.
Okay. So if we said there's pre-exploit strengthening, hardening, whatever you want to call it, and post-exploit is where you guys focus. Have you kind of said, oh, we give up on the stopping people from getting in the first place? It's not possible. We just have to deal with what the after effects are. Is that kind of where you guys take the stance?
No, I don't think at all. I think that there's a sandbox that everybody should play in, that every kid should play in, and I think the one that we've chosen to play in is the post-exploit. There are a lot of vendors out there, some of them that are our partners, that are very much interested in hardening the walls, making the fence high enough, difficult enough, electrifying it so that no one can climb over it. That's not where we choose the space that we choose to play in. Where we want to be is the place where if you were to be breached at some point in time, then we want to help you identify those breaches and provide the most visibility that we can around that particular incident.
Okay.
The indicators of compromise are our business.
Uh-huh.
As I mentioned earlier, 17 years ago when we got started as a DDoS company, so that's what we were mostly focused on. We service 9 of the top 10 service providers in the world. Of that information, we're taking that information and we're anonymizing that data and we're saying, hey, this data is now providing us with indicators of compromise. Now that we have this data, we see some of those known bads, those known bads. Putting different known bads together allows us to figure out what the unknown known is.
Gotcha. So that helps us kind of define where your space is, what you work in. Now, DDoS is very interesting because a lot of times we look at DDoS as just something that is outside of our control. It's distributed, you know, sometimes millions of computers all hitting one computer. How do you, you know, get around that is kind of just wait for it to be over. But explain to us what you guys do in that space and how maybe you can even start to thwart some of these DDoS attacks.
So you explained it in an interesting way. You said, how do you get around a DDoS attack and wait for it to be over? No, you can stop a DDoS attack and clean the traffic. You can drop the packets that are known bad, and you can let the normal traffic continue on through. So there are different types of DDoS attacks. You can have a network-centric DDoS attack, which is mostly volumetric. That's overloading a targeted resource. You know, that's what you just described as consuming all the available bandwidth.
Okay.
And there's another type of attack, which is a protocol attack. So that targets the network layer or the transport layer, and that is interested in using flaws in those. So you can have a UDP attack. You're just trying to overwhelm those type of targeted resources. Then there's a third type of DDoS attack that's called an application layer attack. And what that's designed to do is it's designed to say, hey, I'm looking for a database or an application service, and I'm going to overload that with a number of calls. So the inundation of that particular packet at that particular call causes a denial of service. So it's just too many hitting the application. Say, you know, that's what we try to do. Our appliances, both hardware appliances and software virtual appliances, have the ability to both provide visibility into the type of attack that's happening and to allow you to mitigate that type of attack. So we can say, hey, you know, you've got this type of attack, it's a volumetric attack, we can spread the data over. We have a cloud service, which enables you, if you're getting flooded, you have too much bandwidth coming into your pipe, you can overload, you can fail over some of that through our cloud service.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we do this is our secret sauce. It's one of those things that we like to say we're the best in the industry. I think it's widely known. acknowledge that we do this better than anyone else, and it's why we're generally recognized as the market leader in DDoS.
Okay. I want to talk about that and some of your numbers and what times to shut down or times it takes right after we hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Jason Gould from Arbor Networks, and we were talking before the break about DDoS attacks, and that Arbor Networks is kind of the known name for thwarting DDoS attacks with some products they even have, some hardware, some software products. So, Jason, I would love to know what your effectiveness is with thwarting these type of attacks and how you measure that with the different products. You know, what types of, if you're saying, hey, this is attacks we thwart, here's about how long it takes us to be effective, and here's how maybe it works in a generic explanation.
In a generic explanation, I'd like to say that we're the industry leader in time, both time that it takes to cut down a DDoS attack in terms of days, minutes, hours. And then I'd also like to say that in terms of preventing that type of attack in the future, we have the best interface. So we have a big data product that allows you to take information from a lot of sources and visualize it. So we're going to offer the industry-leading capability in terms of days, minutes, hours, and cutting down these type of attacks. But most importantly, if our corporate logo was that we're guardians of the connected world, if we're trying to make sure that the internet is up, and if you are a player on the internet, you have an internet presence, and it doesn't matter what industry, if you're in retail, if you're in finance, insurance, banking, government, all of these things, keeping you safe from DDoS attacks, from advanced threat attacks, keeping your, it's business assurance that we're trying to go after in terms of how we do this particular process. So when it comes to specific times on how long it takes to threat or thwart a specific type of attack, that's something that we'll go through as we sit down with you guys as an organization. Bring those questions to us, and we'd love to take a gander at that.
So you don't have anything you can tell us, hey, we've had this type of attack, this one, and here's how long it takes to shut it down?
I don't like to publish those numbers just per se. It's one of those things where I'm more of, I would definitely love to sit in front of any customer and do a bake-off, but I don't want to say that this is how much it takes us to do, because that's just not how that particular type of thing works. Because if you modify a tech just a little bit, it could change the whole game.
But is it something where we could say it's hours, days, weeks, any kind
it's
of
minutes?
Minutes.
Minutes.
Okay.
It's minutes.
All right. That's kind of what I was looking for. You know, where are we at in the progression of the industry to, you know, be able to identify and kind of start give people an idea of what they can expect if they use some sort of product like that. So now we've talked a lot about enterprise level stuff. This, you know, your products, your services seem to be, you know, for a business. If I had a small business, let's say, and I wanted to start doing some internal hygiene, some self-help in this area, and evaluating where I go for, say, I've had even a DDoS attack, you know, once, and I'm like, okay, now I need to start thinking about it. We have some threats out there that are interested in us. We're big enough, we're turning some heads. When you go in and talk to customers, I'm sure you have a common set of things that these are the things we usually identify and talk to all customers about. They give, you know, somebody a framework to say, here's where you start if you're starting helping yourself. Maybe you have a 1, 2, 3 of things that you could say, hey, start with this internally, start looking at this with your company, and then you get to a point, you know, an enterprise solution like ours come in and we could help out. What would those kind of start self-help steps be?
The first thing that you do in terms of self-help would be to define what your critical assets are. So that if you're a retail organization, your critical assets are going to be that you're subject to PCI compliance. Do you want to make sure that your auditors are satisfied? Because that's something that's going to be important. So critical assets, the first thing. If you're a manufacturing, your critical assets are going to be different. Same thing if you're a Web 2.0 company. So the first thing I like to tell all customers is, help me help you define what your critical assets are. And once we figure out what those are, we'll determine the security policy that is designed to prevent those from being exfiltrated. The second thing I'd like to say is that we want to open up internal silos. So how we do that is we look at an organization and we say, hey, this is my particular organization. These are maybe I've got a network team here and I've got a security team here and I've got a database team here. Maybe they don't all talk to each other. Maybe they are very protective over some of the information that they hold. What we want to do is we want to open up those silos and say, hey, now that we are going to have an information sharing program, this will enable us to look for anomalies that will lead to threats in a fashion that fits with our organization. The third thing I want to do is I want to say, hey, once I've defined what my assets are, and then I've opened up the silos, now I want to look at my security policy from a holistic view. So 15 years ago, everything was basically on-prem. It was built in a data center. You could build a wall high and wide, and it could be breached, but maybe that wasn't such a big thing. But the assets were biggest threats then were inside. Now, if you look at it, you've got SaaS applications. So a lot of people are using things such as O365 or Google Apps. Then you have the IaaS platforms. So that's infrastructure as a service. That's basically saying, hey, you know, we've got a development team that's got some stuff in Amazon or some stuff in Azure. Then you have platform as a service. So people who are using tools from Salesforce and different organizations like that. All of that and making sure that is broadly defined when you're looking at your security strategy is probably one of the most important things that you can do. And the last thing that you can do, because that's all technical, and I'm a really big fan of technical assets and determining policy through the technical, but what I want to do is to look at the people. If individual people within the organization are going to be the biggest threat to your organization. So if that's the case, then let them help you define your security strategy. Say, hey, I understand that you want to develop in Amazon or in Azure because you're a DevOps team, and that's important to you. You know, speed and agility are very important to you. If that's the case, then send me the logs that I need from Amazon so that I can make sure that, you know, your keys aren't compromised or that no one is exfiltrating data from our Amazon instances. It's building upon the last one that I saw because it's saying, hey, these are the technical assets that are determining our security policy. Now we're asking those users to help us protect those technical assets. And if we do that along with some physical security, you know, making sure that we have a consistent disaster recovery policy and business continuity policy, and last but not least, physical security. So if it's, you know, you're walking out of the building, you guys have a swipe badge to get in the building, make sure that no one's following you in without swiping in. It's everybody's got to play a part in this, from the janitor to the CEO. And making sure that everybody follows these rules will keep the organization secure from a technical level. It'll keep it secure from a business continuity, say if there was an earthquake or a fire or something like that, as well as from people who may just walk in the back door.
Mm-hmm. So I hear quite often within corporate structures, silos, education, making everybody more aware, breaking down the teams that kind of hold things apart. What are the human reasons that you usually see for the current infrastructure when you go into a company being siloed and not talking? What are the things that can break, that you see as commonality in different organizations that are either having a reluctance to make this change or an organizational culture that makes it difficult?
The big things are different people have different priorities. So if you're a security team, your priority is going to be preventing data exfiltration.
Uh-huh.
If you are a storage and networking team, your priority is going to be on assurance. You want things up. You want to make sure that your apps are up, that your network is up and functioning well, that your pipe is clean. If you're a DevOps team, you want to be focused on speed and agility. The more that you can develop, instead of worrying about a security flaw for a lot of DevOps people, they just kill the application and start over again. So they're really big in the container space and in the and with some of the newer technologies that are in the Linux kernel that allow them to do more than what they would have done before, where if they would have had an application that potentially had a flaw, they would have had to go in and find the flaw. Now they just kill the entire application and start over again. Mm-hmm. And they do that because there are base images that are sitting out there in GitHub and that they can use, so they're not required to develop the app again from ground up. They're starting with, think of it like a plan, like an architectural map. They have blueprints. Before, if you didn't have blueprints, you had to develop everything from scratch. It made it a little more difficult. Today, when you can go out to GitHub and just get blueprints, and that's everything that you need to get up and running again, it's not such a big deal to kill an app that maybe has a flaw in it.
Yeah. So it sounds like, though, you know, basically we're saying put everybody under the security, the CIS, the CISOs, Chief Information Security Officers, you know, realm, you know, and make everybody be aware of security. But that doesn't seem like it's even possible in a lot of organizations, because that would slow things down. What do you think about? And I know that's what I hear as kind of the corporate pushback on why that those type of changes would happen.
A lot of times the CISO comes from a technical background. And in my opinion, most CISOs need to be policymakers. So they are a technical asset that a VP of security infrastructure can provide to a chief information security officer. But too often these days, the CISO looks very much like an engineer or an architect in IT. That is just a piece of the business. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is we need to diversify the CISO talent so that the CISO talent are people who get things done. They're operators. Because one of the things, if we're going to clear up these silos within business and we're going to make the business function in a way that best fits the security policy and it makes this and it's going to be successful, you need to have a CISO that has the ability to work within these different teams, to work within different pieces of the business, and then actually execute and accomplish upon those things that they've identified as problems and or initiatives.
Yeah, it almost sounded like you just said that there's a personality piece to this, that it requires a certain personality at the top of this that's not a engineer, go into the deep roots on everything, but as a get the business rolling type person.
Absolutely, and that's one of the most important things. That's one of the most important aspects to being a good CISO is somebody who can actually get things done. That person, that ability to execute and not to just design and be, you know, it's not sitting in a dark room looking at blue screens and green screens. Those are not skills of a good CISO. The skills the CISOs need are skills that that allow the business to actually function in the world that it's playing in.
Okay.
So if you have a business that's online, if you have a business that shares information with vendors, you have a business that does most of what modern businesses do, all of that is going to require an excellent CISO, because the CISO is going to be necessary to make those things work in a way that keeps the organization secure and compliant in most cases.
Okay. Well, fair enough. So just kind of pulling towards the end of the show here, I wanted to, I know you had talked about the unknown knowns. And we had talked about DDoS. We didn't go a lot into some of the other ones, but I would like to give you the opportunity to say, hey, here's the type of things we do at Arbor Networks. Here's the type of customers we engage with, and here's how you can engage with us.
Sure. So the first thing I'd like to say is thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And the type of things that we do, so obviously we do DDoS. We're really good at this. The next thing that we do is we look at advanced persistent threats. So we're saying, you know, hey, these are APTs that are out there. We're going to give you visibility into those. The last thing I'd like to do is we'd like to say, hey, here's a zero-day flyer. Here's ransomware. Those are other things that we do really well, giving you post-exploit visibility with regard to those. The last thing I'd like to say is how you engage with us. So we're at a lot of different trade shows out there. So Black Hat, Cisco Live. You can go to our website, www.arbor.net. You can also check us out through our parent company, NetScout. So we have a lot of integrations with what they do. They do service assurance and network assurance, network performance management, application performance management. The last thing that I'd like to say is if you take anything out of this conversation, just when you go back, if you're just a regular person, a secretary, a business analyst, VP of sales. Whatever you do, go back and say, hey, what am I doing within my organization to make this organization secure? And if you ask that up, if you send that up through the ranks, doesn't matter who you are, I'd like to hear some of the different answers that you guys are getting, because I know that I spend time, you know, helping develop our products and talking to different customers every day, but obviously I talk to 250, 300 customers a year. I would love to hear from more of you. And my email is jgould@arbor.net. So give me your responses and let me know what you think. Just tell me your just simple things about security in your organization.
All right, thank you. And also, use the page on our website, the comments at the bottom. Put some comments in there for Jason, and we can field them publicly as well and see what everybody has to say about the topic. But thanks a lot. We've been talking to Jason Gould from Arbor Networks today on New Cyber Frontier. Have a great day. The views or opinions expressed during this podcast are not those of Colorado Technical University.
Enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.